Со двора подъезд известный под названием «Черный ход». В том подъезде, как в поместье, проживает черный кот. Он в усы усмешку прячет, темнота ему как щит. Все коты поют и плачут.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. Every podcast, I talk to an author about their new book on Russia or Eurasia. In this episode, I spoke with Louis Siegelbaum about his new book, Cars for Comrades, The Life of the Soviet Automobile. A recent editorial in the Moscow Times declared that, in Moscow, the car is king. Indeed, one word Moscovites constantly mutter is probka, or traffic jam. The boom in car ownership is transforming Russian life, and for some, not necessarily for the better. Quote, the joy of personal mobility has completely eclipsed the value of community life. But the joy of car ownership has long ceased being a joy and has instead become a burden, end quote. While the detrimental effects of the car have only recently hit Russia, the automobile's political, economic, and cultural significance dates from the early Soviet period. What the Soviets called automobilism had multiple meanings. It represented a particular Soviet modernity rooted in industrialism, technology, and the efficiency of the socialist system. It also meant state power, and during the Great Terror in particular, the secret police. But the car also signified freedom, individuality, and leisure. The Soviet car may have been an unattainable luxury for the vast majority of Soviet citizens, but its effects on the Soviet imagination were deep and long-lasting. So without further delay, here's my interview with Louis Siegelbaum. Hi, Louis.
Hello, Sean.
Welcome to New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies. Thanks for taking the time to talk about your book, Cars for Comrades, The Life of the Soviet Automobile.
My pleasure.
Just to begin the interview, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Okay. I was born in New York and raised in the Sylvan suburbs of Long Island. And I was a little unusual in my neighborhood in that my parents, particularly my father, was very politically active. And in fact, in the years just before I was born, had been active in the American Communist Party. He ceased to be active when he was chucked out of the New York City school system by the then teachers union that purged communists from its membership. So I grew up in the shadow of McCarthyism. My dad changed careers, always regretted not continuing his activism, but found it impossible to do so in those circumstances. And as I grew into a sense of consciousness of my family's past and the American political situation, I became interested in trying to figure it all out. And so by the time I went to Columbia in 1966, I was already quite politically conscious and felt myself being very much on the left. And of course, the 60s, particularly the latter part of the 60s, was a period when that was by no means unusual. And so as an undergraduate at Columbia, a political science major, I was keen to learn as much as I could about international relations, the war in Vietnam being very much in the forefront of everyone's consciousness. I joined the Students for Democratic Society. I participated actively in the student rebellion of Columbia in '68, and got to know some professors, not only in the classroom but outside of it, among whom I will single out the young Stephen Cohen, who was something of a role model for me now that I look back on it, although I don't think that concept had yet been invented. Coming out of 68 and its militants, I continued to remain fascinated with the Soviet Union as the fount of, you know, where it all started. Unlike many of my comrades who were into peasant studies and Latin America and Southeast Asian studies and so forth. And so I learned Russian beginning as an undergraduate and decided to pursue graduate studies. Thanks to a fellowship from Columbia, I went to St. Anthony's College, Oxford, for what I thought would be a year or two, but which turned out to be where I did my PhD. And that was partly because it was a convenient way of remaining outside of the United States during a period when I thought that best. I was a draft dodger, I visited my parents only very seldomly. And after a couple of years of further language training and studying as much as I could, more from fellow students, learning more from fellow students than my advisor, I went on the U.S. Program IREX to Moscow. 1973-74, and I pursued a dissertation that had to do with the Russian bourgeoisie, particularly those involved with industry and war production during the First World War. I spent these 10 months in Moscow with a komandirovka to Leningrad. I had met my future wife in Finland the year before, and we got married, so that seemed to be the only way she could accompany me on the exchange program. We came back. I defended the dissertation in 1975 and took up a position in far-off Australia, which continued to keep me outside of the United States, but also was one of the very few jobs available in a field that had really quite radically downsized by the mid-70s.
Hey, can I ask you a question really quick? Because your biography is fascinating in and of itself. Were you staying out of the United States for legal reasons or just out of political preference?
A little bit of both. That is, I wasn't sure that what my legal status was, but I certainly didn't miss things in the United States.
I see.
It wasn't until 1983, although I'll come back to the intervening years, that I returned to the United States for good. I went to Melbourne, where I taught at La Trobe University from 1976 to 1983. It was, on reflection, a good way of learning how to teach Russian history. I had a lot of young and very enthusiastic colleagues. I began doing scholarship there in a serious way. As far off as it was, I did get some leave time to travel to the Soviet Union and also to the United States for research purposes. But after a certain amount of time, beyond the sort of 3-4 years that I had assumed I would be there, it really started to get oppressively far away. That is, both from my family in the United States, as well as anything to do with Russia.
Right, I can imagine.
Yes, and I'll add, this is before there was anything known as email or or Skype, I remember fax machines had just come in at this point, so That was a tenuous link. And so in 1983, I accepted this offer from Michigan State. I had been shortlisted at one or two places the previous couple of years, but this time there was a real offer, and I accepted it with enthusiasm. Came here, as I talked to you from East Lansing, and have remained ever since. In terms of the focus of my research, by the time I came to Michigan, I had moved into the Soviet period, which perhaps previous guests of yours have touched on this, but up until the late 70s or early 1980s, believe it or not, it was almost impossible to be considered a genuine historian and to work on the Soviet period. Archival access for the Soviet period being so difficult to obtain, many historians felt there was a certain lack of legitimacy among Russianists who might dare consider themselves historians.
Right, and for you and others of your generation, also the whole question of social history was considered impossible.
That's correct. That's correct. I remember a big breakthrough coming in 1980 when I went to the World Congress on whatever it was called then, the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, which was held in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, West Germany, and there encountered all kinds of people doing essentially exactly what I had begun to do, which was Soviet labor history. And these included Don Filzer and people from Germany itself and a couple of other Brits. I began to hear about Hiroaki Koromiya, then a graduate student at Princeton. It seemed in recollection to happen all of a sudden that there was this cohort of people who were doing Soviet labor history.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thrust of that was the discovery that, you know, the kind of explanations of labor and its organization and remuneration and identification that we had gotten from Soviet sources didn't stand up to our investigations into the kinds of sources that had long existed and been available, but were not hadn't been looked at very carefully. I have in mind things like the Harvard Interview Project, which goes by another title and is now available online and, you know, is a very useful source for all kinds of purposes. So even Soviet newspapers, one could glean certain things from that that hadn't, you know, hadn't been paid attention to.
And, of course, the Smolensk Archive, which was a gold mine for those for researchers as yourself.
Exactly, the Smolensk Archive as well. And so several of us, I guess your advisor as well by this point, your former advisor, Arch Getty, had begun to make use of these sources and come up with you know, quite radically different understandings of, you know, the social bases of Soviet power. I think, you know, Sheila Fitzpatrick's analysis or reflections of that period are on the mark in the sense that generally we were animated by the question of what was the social support, what was the nature of the social support for the Stalinist project.
Let me ask you a question about as a participant in that the so-called revisionists in the 80s. you know, now 20-some years later, or actually now 30 years later, one should say, where do you, how do you, when you look back on the work you guys were doing in terms of establishing social history of Soviet Russia, and in reflection to what's been done since the archives have opened, where do you evaluate that body of work that you guys did?
It's a question I have asked myself many times.
I mean, what is your legacy? Let me put it to you this way.
Yeah. Well, I look at it as a phase in the evolution of Western understandings of Soviet history, a phase that broke through this, you know, rather unilinear view of the Soviet regime, proceeding according to its own lights and on the basis of its own, you know, ideologically driven agenda. I mean, of course, to some extent, some of the assertions that were made concerning social support or to take some of the views that, you know, Arch, for example, used to represent, although I want to come back to a distinction that I would make between his work and mine, for example, you know, about Stalin was dependent on coalitions and not entirely in control and almost defeated at certain points in the fulfillment of his agenda. I think, you know, there are certain of those kinds of things that one would want to amend, if not correct. It's not that the sort of post-revisionist wave has obliterated what we did, so much as I would say expanded the purview of social history into other realms. You know, I mean, I look at the Foucault revolution, if you will, pretty much in the same way. It didn't so much overturn or make redundant, you know, what had been a dominant sort of Marxist perspective of a previous generation, so much as enriched it.
And as a social historian, and I think you would still describe yourself as such, and certainly Cars for Comrades speaks to social history, where mm-hmm. do you evaluate social history in Russian studies today?
I think I would say that there's still a lot of it to do. you know, whereas the temporal focus has moved forward, the proverbial cutting edge of Soviet history has now reached the Khrushchev era, if not even beyond. I think the social dimensions of the Soviet experience, you know, are there to be written.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to cite one example from work I'm currently doing that we can get back to later on, very, very little has been written about one of the major processes, the major sort of social phenomena of the second half of the Soviet period. I'm speaking of the rural to urban migration of the 60s and 70s,
right.
Beginning already in the 50s. I mean, this is a massive, really fundamental change in a way no less significant than that which Misha Levin wrote about in terms of the ruralization of the cities in the 30s, albeit extended over a longer period of time and not having quite the same effect, but nonetheless an experience that involved millions and millions and that, you know, fundamentally changed the nature of the Soviet of Soviet society.
Yeah, well, we'll get back to that. As someone who, of course, as you well know, studies the 1920s, I would say that there's still, though everyone is migrating forward, I still think that there's a lot to be said for the 1920s. And sometimes I in my some moments, I lament the fact that there's been this exodus. but that's my own editorializing. Let's move on to Cars for Comrades. In a way, the book kind of flows from your work on Russian labor. But how did you end up writing a book about the Soviet car?
Well, I guess there were two impulses. One was having visited Russia many times in the 1990s, noticing this explosion of cars on the streets of Moscow and other cities, and also in staying with Russians and just sort of listening to people talking, becoming aware of how frequently cars came up and how you know, it seemed to be something to the effect of the kid who had not been allowed into the candy shop suddenly, you know, finding him or herself surrounded by the stuff. And also, thereby, you know, casting my glance back to the Soviet period, discovering that actually cars were there as well, but, you know, sort of hidden in plain view. Cars were not something that one tends to associate with the Soviet project, for good reason. But that nonetheless, or paradoxically, therefore, they were an important item. And you can find that, as I did in doing the research for Cars for Comrades, in all kinds of places. I mean, in novels, in films, in songs, in speeches by Soviet leaders, in, you know, memoirs, etc. Just all over. The other source of inspiration, and this relates back to the discussion we were just having about Soviet labor history, was my own weariness with what had become in the 90s and to a large extent still remains the dominant narrative of Soviet history as being one of what I refer to sort of metaphorically as tears, oppression, violence, terror, a narrative especially prominent and appropriate to accounts of the Stalin era. And of course, this was a period of my own research, for the most part, and I longed to escape from it. And I longed for a subject that would encompass the entirety of Soviet history and also have an emphasis on the post-Stalin decades.
And it's interesting you chose the car because the car, of course, represents individuality, freedom, expression of identity. It's interesting that in an effort to move away from a history of tears, you pick something that really is emblematic of freedom.
Well, it is and it was, but what I discovered in the course of doing the research for the book is that that was not its only symbolic meaning or association. That, in fact, in the Soviet context, cars could have exactly the opposite meaning. And that stemmed from the fact that the overwhelming majority of four-wheeled vehicles that were produced, because actually trucks were much more numerous than cars, were state-owned. And were symbolic of state power. So you have people in villages, for example, whenever a car would appear, assuming, quite rightly, for the most part, that it was some state official coming in to bother them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In which case, cars were not something that were associated
certainly.
With or, as one encounters in the diary of Nina Lugovskaya, which was published in English a few years ago as the diary of a Soviet schoolgirl, this encounter with Stalin's car being driven through the Novodevichy Cemetery at night in Moscow. And, you know, this kind of gothic scene that she lays out, as well as the, of course, well-known descriptions of the so-called Black Mariahs that flew through the streets of Moscow and other cities during the terror to round up people in the middle of the night.
Yeah, so the car, as you show, is a quite mixed thing. I mean, it's we can't really impose our own, as I did in my statement, kind of impose our own American ideas of what the car represents, since in Soviet Russia it's in a completely different context in terms of distribution and use.
That's right.
And et cetera. So just to get on to the meat of the book, the first part you talk about the establishment of the Soviet car industry, particularly in factories in Moscow, Nizhny Novgorod, and the city of Togliatti. Why are these three cities important for understanding the Soviet car industry?
Well, I use these three, and of course there were other places where cars and trucks were produced, but these seem to me to be the most significant in that they each represented a moment or phase in the Soviet car industry, its relationship to sort of global car production. So we start with Moscow and AMO, which in the early 30s was renamed ZIS, Zavod imeni Stalina. And then in the mid-50s, ZIL, once, of course, Stalin became the target of Khrushchev's secret speech and had his name started to be replaced. ZIS took on the name of the former director of the factory, Lihachev. So this is where the first Soviet cars were built, and they were built in, appropriately enough, Proletarsky Raion, the proletarian district of Moscow, a highly industrialized area. And so a lot of the chapter actually is about that district and the working and living conditions around the factory, but also about the connections with the American car industry that were begun to be made towards the end of the 1920s. And, you know, each chapter, of course, goes through the entirety of the Soviet period. So I follow the story of AMO, ZIS, ZIL up through the post-Soviet years. But in terms of sort of significant moments, the book then shifts to GAZ, the Gorky Automobile Factory in Nizhny Novgorod, whose moment, as it were, comes with the building of the factory, thanks to an agreement with the Ford Motor Company, which supplied the technology and a lot of the engineering and technical expertise. So that chapter is about the setting up of the factory, the contributions that were made to it by Americans, among whom were the Reuther brothers, Walter and Victor, who in the 1950s assumed the leadership of the United Automobile Workers Union. the experience of this factory through the war years when it was bombed, and its sort of golden age in the 50s and 60s when the sort of emblematic Soviet vehicles, the Volga, the Pobeda, the Volga, and the Chaika were produced there. And then on to Tolyatti, which is a city on the Volga named after an Italian communist that 2 years after its renaming as Tolyatti was chosen as the site for the building of this giant factory based on Fiat technology. And so in 1966, this factory started to be erected, and by 1970 was turning out little Fiat clones, which in Russia came to be known as Zhiguli, and when they exported them, were known as Ladas. And this was a city that was an entirely new discovery for me. I visited twice. And the first time, just sort of on a whim from Moscow, I walked into a travel agency and said, "Get me to Tolyatti." And the second time for a conference. The company, the Vaz or Avtovaz, as it's called today, was very hospitable to me and to my interests. And I owe considerable thanks to them for the resources that were made available to me.
Well, let's talk about Tolyatti for a bit, because you describe it. I mean, one of the things with auto production, of course, is the cities and the conditions, working and living conditions around them. And for Tolyatti, you describe it as a third-generation Soviet city. What does that mean, and how does that make it different than from previous so-called socialist cities?
It was a city that was built all of a piece. That is to say, that part of a pre-existing city, there was something in the way of a city already with considerable pharmaceutical industries as its economic base. But associated with the car factory was built an entirely new, you could say, city or part of Tolyatti that was called the Auto District, Auto Factory District. And this was a third-generation Soviet city in the sense that it was designed all of a piece and built on the basis of a kind of integrated plan, very much derived from cosmopolitan, modernist, international modernist principles, very much indebted to Le Corbusier. This meant that that there were micro districts, each of which had calculated for it so many shops, so many steps that the residents would have to take to get to the tram stop and the library, and so it was very much kind of planned city. The result of which is quite alienating.
One could imagine.
quite sort of overwhelmingly hostile to, you know, what I think generally urbanists today regard as kind of necessary ingredients for habitability, you know, sort of cafes and street life and, a kind of coziness that people are able to carve out of the urban environment. It was that much more difficult to do in Tolyatti and other cities of its nature.
Now, let's talk about something that is throughout the book, which is the influence of the United States. What role did the Soviet fascination with the United States, American industrial efficiency, and the American automobile itself factor into the development of the Soviet car industry?
It's an enormous role. I mean, it's to turn Marx's famous phrase about communism being the specter that haunts Europe. In a sense, the United States and its car industry and car culture really haunt the Soviet experience of automobiles. And this goes back to something we were talking about a moment ago. I mean, even during the 30s, when, you know, there were these quite negative associations with cars, one also finds kids, yearning for the sight of an American automobile. Treasuring pictures of them that would occasionally appear in Soviet publications. And that continued, on through the subsequent decades. So the United States, and Henry Ford, exercised enormous influence on the Soviet imagination. Henry Ford is a fascinating character in terms of both positive and negative associations. There's the famous trip of Mayakovsky to Detroit that I refer to in the book. Where he's contemptuous of the pace at which workers are forced to work and their exhaustion at the end of the day, so much so that, you know, the divorce rate is so high in Detroit because wives can't get their husbands to pay attention to them. And yet there is an unmistakable admiration. And this comes out in a lot of the writing of others, including this, I think I refer to him as sort of poet of Soviet industrialization, Boris Agapov, who watches the construction of the assembly line at Gaz, thanks to Ford technology, and has these sort of dreams of, you know, cars rolling down this assembly line one every so many seconds. And it is this sort of techno dream that is derived from the American experience.
In a way, it seems that the Soviets connect economic success and economic progress, similar to how in the United States a car represents the same thing. There seems to be a convergence of viewpoints on this around the car.
Yes. Even more so in terms of car production in the Soviet Union, such that, in terms of the official culture or what could be said to be car culture, it wasn't so much, the joys of driving a car or being on the open road, but rather the cars coming off the assembly line automatically, as it were, that were celebrated.
Now, when talking about cars, and we'll get to the actual car itself in a little bit, but you also have to talk about roads, and Russia is known for having horrible roads. What are some of the problems that Russia faces when it comes to constructing and maintaining roads, and how did this present a problem for, say, the proliferation of cars?
Weather and climate are a lethal combination, such that there are these periods of the times of the year, the fall and spring, when even to this day, some roads are impassable. This is the notorious Rasputitsa, the mud phenomenon. Difficulty of constructing roads and maintaining them owes a lot of it to these factors. There was nothing in the way of gasoline tax or allocations of federal funding such as existed in the United States. But what there was a perceived surplus of labor, such as to make the so-called trudovaya povinnost, the labor duty, the solution. So throughout the Stalin era, most road maintenance was done on the basis of labor obligation that was imposed on rural inhabitants, such that it was 6 days a year, could be more, could be less, depends on whether they brought their horses or not, etc.
And if I remember, if my memory serves me, this is a holdover from the Tsarist period.
It's a revival of mm-hmm. That's right, a policy that was pursued in Tsarist times, and you know, I should add, was not unique to Russia, but certainly was kind of reinvented in the Soviet period and applied on a scale that I don't think was matched anywhere else, at least not in the 20th century, this was where the Society for the Construction and Improvement of Roads came into its own, this Aufdor, which was one of these supposedly volunteer societies that existed in the 20s and 30s, because its task was to mobilize and popularize road improvement with competitions and prizes and auto rallies organized for that purpose.
Talk about these road rallies, because you deal with them at some length. What were these exactly, and how did they draw attention to Soviet roadlessness?
Well, one of the discoveries I made in the course of this research was how could it have been possible that I didn't notice the coverage of these when I had been reading Pravda, for example, for other purposes, because whenever there was a major Avtoprobeg, or I translate it as rally, but it's kind of like a test run of sorts. I mean, it's not a rally in the sense that we have rallies in this country, and even more so in some other parts of the world that are kind of regular annual events, and where there's a lot of competition and points, and you know, it's a whole kind of NASCAR equivalent, I suppose. But it rather was organized to popularize the new vehicles that the Soviet Union had put out, or to draw attention to the necessity for building better roads, or roads where they didn't exist previously, and which, in terms of the major ones, you know, had daily coverage by correspondents who went along for the ride. And were really kind of the equivalent of adventure stories. I mean, these were kind of expeditions that were intended to sort of fire the imagination of their readers, and were, I might add, lampooned famously by Ilf and Petrov.
Uh-huh. Yes.
In The Little Golden Calf. You know, I mean, it's hard to convey the humor, but it is very funny.
Nice. Well, let's turn to the actual car itself. What were Soviet cars like in terms of their design, their quality, and their usability? And where did they draw their when did car makers draw, or designers draw, their inspiration from?
Soviet cars are notoriously difficult to drive, lack maneuverability, break down easily, and otherwise are no fun. However, partly because of those things, certainly helping to contextualize those characteristics, are certain qualities such as durability. They last, and the ease with which they can be repaired. And I think this is a key. Actually, it's true not only of Soviet cars in general, but cars throughout the Eastern Bloc, that they are built and sold or distributed with the understanding on the part of those who acquire them that they are going to need to know how to repair those cars. And so they come usually with, you know, repair kits and sometimes tools to do that. Now, of course, that's largely in reference to the cars that became available for purchase. At the upper levels, you have the limos, you have the sort of the state on wheels, as I refer to them, the Zil limos, the Chaika, that were inspired by and almost exact copies of certain Western sort of luxury cars, the Packard, the Cadillac, and such like.
Now, one of the things about cars, of course, in the Soviet Union is who can acquire them and how does one acquire them. Now, just speaking for individual car owners, which, as you say, in the mid-1960s, car production turns more towards passenger cars. It becomes more of a for consumers. How did someone acquire a car in the Soviet Union? And I say acquire because it's more of access than of actual purchase.
Right. One purchased a car through one's trade union, and one got on a waiting list as early as possible. But the significant obstacle was the necessity of putting down a hefty down payment. There was no credit here. One put down a down payment, and upon notice that the car would be ready to be picked up, one had to come up with the balance.
And how long would it take for someone to get a car?
The average kept on creeping up. So it was about 5 to 6 years in the 60s and 70s and got to be about 8 years by the 80s. And this was despite increasing car production. So there was no shortage of demand. In fact, I argue in the book that demand is not really an operative category, that there was desire. And only a small proportion of those who desired had the opportunity or, you know, got the turn to acquire a car. But of course, there were ways of coping with that too. The thriving secondhand car market was one. And so cars lasted longer than they were anticipated to last. And this is another aspect of Soviet car culture. It was that one not only looked after one's car, but one cherished the opportunity to have one and spent time with the car and with others who owned cars that, I argue is a very important dimension of male sociability.
Mm-hmm.
That really was an important way in which men kind of reconfirmed their masculinity.
Mm-hmm. And would you argue that this was in this kind of state versus society binary, if we just kind of play with that, is this a way for people to kind of socialize with themselves and kind of organize themselves outside the purview of the state? Would you go so far as to suggest that?
Although I'm uncomfortable with the state-society binary, I would say that that cars did constitute a site of private space, and I think I even refer to them as kind of alternative living rooms, so that the garages where they were housed, if there were garages, the courtyards where many of them were kept, These became, and of course, the interiors of the cars themselves were sites of privacy. In fact, this was another thing I noticed in the 90s when I started to be aware of cars in Russia. How many people simply sat in their cars?
Mm-hmm.
Not in traffic, but you know, just
hanging out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've noticed the same thing. And of course, this makes sense if you consider the fact that, you know, there's a shortage of living space in terms of access to housing. I mean,
exactly.
Private space within one's apartment is limited. And this is why I think, you know, when you go in Russia, a lot more people are out, especially young people, are outside in these apartment courtyards. They're outside in parks. And then I've also noticed this just hanging out in cars, too.
Yes. Although in Soviet times, very few young people, if we're talking about people in their teens or early 20s, had cars.
Yes. If they
did, it was through their parents. But therefore there really is no Soviet equivalent that I was able to discover to, you know, a kind of youth culture associated with cars.
Yeah, I think that is actually developing now to some extent.
I believe so, too.
Yeah, I noticed a lot more young people have cars now than, well, more people in general. I mean, anyone who goes to Moscow now, you can't escape it. It's just unbelievable, the amount of traffic and the amount of cars. One of the questions that you seem to try to answer is whether there's anything particularly Soviet about the Soviet car. What is your answer? Did you find an answer to that question? And if so, what is it?
I would say there is no one thing that made the Soviet car Soviet. Part of it is the I spoke about earlier, the adulation of the assembly line and, you know, the production values associated with cars, which was at its height under Stalin. It continued into the 60s, so that when Vaz was being built and then started to go into production, there still is this, you know, the sort of techno worship associated with the car. So I'd say that's one thing. The other, though, is the kind of multivalence of meanings or associations with cars, such that there is unquestionably the association of cars with freedom. And by the way, not only cars, but, you know, I think I quote from a novel by Anatoly Rybakov, a passage in which a truck driver is going down the road and he's, you know, sort of bursting into song practically, celebrating the open road and putting the pedal to the metal and, you know, this freedom, etc. So, you know, just being out there on the road in your car is definitely part of the Soviet experience, but also its opposite. So, you know, there is this plethora, this sort of continuum of associations with cars that I think extends well beyond where it exists in, for example, this country.
And also, you can see it continue, too, with in post-Soviet Russia, with the blue lights on top of cars, or the association with BMWs with power, too.
Yes, yes. Well, there's also, you know, a kind of patriotic or nationalistic dimension to what happens, especially in the post-Soviet period, with the influx of Mercedes and the association of people driving them with, you know, illegal sources of income and, you know, chujia, you know, sort of foreignness, as opposed to, you know, us Lada driving, you know, sort of law-abiding citizens. And so, I mean, there are lots of these, even in Soviet times, jokes that pit the Mercedes against the humble Zaporozhets, this little tiny rattle trap of a car. You know, it's kind of like the hare and the tortoise.
And the irony, though, now, especially since the recent protests in the Far East about the hike in taxes on foreign cars, now because the desire for access to cheaper cars, now you get protests against making foreign cars more expensive. I mean, this became a touchy subject for the Russian government in the last 2 years or so.
It's been fascinating to see how car owners have come to be, you know, like a social category with a certain degree of activism associated with them and a kind of pressure group. Yeah, exactly.
What is the status of the Russian car industry today? Because if you go to Moscow now, which of course, you know, as anyone who says Moscow isn't Russia, but it's also the place that has the most cars, you see more foreign cars today than you see Russian cars. What is the Russian car industry today?
Well, some of those foreign cars are actually assembled in Russia. So Ford and Toyota and a lot of foreign auto companies have set up assembly plants in Russia. There's a big Ford plant outside of Petersburg, for example. Others are imported, as you were mentioning a moment ago, or certainly in the 90s, were being smuggled in from Japan. Through Finland from Germany, there still are cars made in Russia that are, you know, Russian made, and they are the current day version of the Lada. So Avtovaz is now the sole maker of passenger cars for domestic consumption, but they're relatively downscale. They're humble. They're simple. They're not flashy, and they're affordable.
One of the things I have noticed in Russia in terms of cars is that the Russian government has made a commitment to try to reestablish the Russian car industry and even go through make these gestures like now Putin no longer will ride around in a Mercedes, he'll ride right. around in a Zeal.
Right.
So there is this connection, as you say, with a kind of patriotism.
Well, and indeed, I wanted to add that actually since the book was published or at least completed, Avtovaz has been if not entirely nationalized, then certainly heavily indebted to the Russian government, which I think owns about 40% of the company, and another 40% or so is Renault. The extent to which this is a company that is identifiably Russian is somewhat questionable. But the Russian government definitely has tried to subsidize its car industry.
Well, I thank you so much for your time. It's a fascinating topic, especially since cars play such a big role in the American imagination. It's nice that you've devoted a book to the car and the Soviet imagination. Just to wrap up the interview, what are you working on now?
I having written a book about auto mobility, have plunged into a very large topic on mobility in the form of migration. With my colleague Leslie Mock, who is a migration historian, albeit of the rest of Europe, I'm doing a project on migration within Russian political space from the 18th century to the present.
Oh, wow. That is a very, very large topic.
Well, the main theme or argument, I would say, is that one cannot really understand Russian history without appreciating the extent to which the extraordinary, if not unique, extent to which that history is the movement of people either because they moved of their own accord or were moved.
Mm-hmm.
And that we have tended to underappreciate this point.
Right, and I think I think part of it, especially for the 20th century, is that I think we over we put too much power in the effectiveness of internal passports and controlling movement of peoples in Russia.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, I think thank you very much. Thanks again for the interview. It's quite interesting.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Louis Siegelbaum about his book, Cars for Comrades, The Life of the Soviet Automobile. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Once again, I'm Sean Guillory, your host for New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies. If you're interested in hearing more interviews by the New Books Network, please go to newbooksnetwork.com. And be sure to tune in next time when I talk to Charles King about his book, Odessa, Genius and Death in the City of Dreams. Until then, goodbye.
Оттого-то знать не весел дом, в котором мы живем, надо бы лампочку повесить. Денег все не соберем.